Thank you very much. First of all, apologies for being late. These are things which we cannot control in our life. And a lot of the ways which we can deal with the ups and downs and the other problems in life is just to learn that much of our life we cannot do much about. And we cannot control the way people speak to us. We cannot control even our health of our bodies, even though we try. And so much of our life is out of control. But the one part of our life which is in our control is our reactions to the ups and downs of life. We cannot control the world, but we can certainly control our mind. And it's that controlling of the mind, the training of the mind, the learning how to perceive something useful, no matter what one does, is the essence of the talk which I'm going to be giving this evening. One of the important parts of taking Buddhism to a Western country like Australia is being challenged to make Buddhism relevant in such a way that the timeless teachings of a great master can be helpful and useful to people from all walks of life. And I've been broadly successful in that in many areas. And the role of being a monk in a Western country is very different than being a monk in an Asian country, a Buddhist country like Thailand. There that you cannot take respect for granted, you have to earn respect. And you get in situations which you'll never be put in a country like Thailand. So that you do have a different lifestyle being a monk in the West. To give you an example of how you can cope with the difficulties in life, on one evening I was invited by a disciple, an Australian man, to come on a radio talk show. It was a phone-in program where people would phone in and you would have to give answers live on air. This is a very easy thing to do, I thought, but it was a late night show. And it was only when I got into the TV studio that I heard what the program was all about. What TV studio? The radio studio. Because the radio program was on adult themes. It was a sex hotline. And there was I, a Buddhist monk being celibate for 30 years, had to answer questions on sex and relationships. Now the interesting thing is, even though you're in a difficult situation like that, it's wonderful that the training which I've had and the meditation insights which I've developed meant that the few questions I answered at the beginning obviously impressed the listeners, and the two-hour show ended the last hour where I was fielding all the questions, even though there's a well-known Perth psychologist, sexologist sitting next to me. And it's wonderful to understand just how sort of the insights which you gain from a mind-training meditation can be so powerful you can answer questions on all types of subjects. But the point was there that even though you're put in a situation where you're uncomfortable, a situation which is maybe strange, you can use the experiences and insights and ways of the mind to actually to cope no matter whatever happens. And this, again, is the meaning of dealing with the ups and downs of life. No matter what you have to experience, you can always do something with it. And again, as a monk living in the West, you have both extremes. For example, the monastery in which I live, we basically built ourselves. I was a main builder for the very early years, so I had to learn how to build myself. And I do recall one occasion that the monks, myself, were mixing concrete. And if ever you mix concrete, you get the cement dust all over you. And so I was busily helping build up our monastery in Australia. And my robes, my underrobes, were all dirty, messed with concrete and water. And as I went to go to my hut to take a shower, I passed a visitor who had come that day. She was a Sri Lankan lady and very, very well dressed, obviously a high caste lady. And when she approached me, she said, "I'm looking for the abbot, Ajahn Brahm. You know where he is?" And of course, that was me. But I said, "Well, if you go up there to the hall, he'll be there in about 15 minutes." So she went to the hall, and I quickly had a shower, changed my robes, and tidied myself up like a good monk should look, not like a builder on a work site in Bangkok. And when she got up there, and I met her, she was very polite and she was very inspired. And just before she left, she said, "That's wonderful, you've got a beautiful monastery, but if you don't mind me telling you, I saw one of your monks, he was very badly dressed. Please do something about it. I will tell him later on. And of course that monk was me. So no matter what you do, you can always make fun of it and enjoy it. And so part of my life, you know, as a monk in a Western country is, you know, in the ditches, shoveling sand or mixing concrete. But other times, you're at the other end of the spectrum. And since I last gave a talk here, last March, many of you may have seen on the television, there was the Commonwealth Games, which were held in Australia, in Melbourne. And part of the Commonwealth Games meant that the Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth, visited Australia. And being one of the leaders of the Buddhist community, I was invited not to participate in the games. Even though you might think in the ups and downs of life, maybe that if Buddhist monks, especially here in Thailand, I'm sure that some of them can levitate, so maybe you can enter them in the Olympic Games in Beijing in the high jump. Surely they should be able to do something. But no, in this particular occasion, I was invited to a couple of ceremonies and receptions with Queen Elizabeth. But in particular, I was asked to represent the Buddhist community in Australia, which was at least 2% of the population. One out of every 50 Australians is Buddhist. I was asked to represent the Buddhist community in a state dinner in Parliament House. Now, first of all, when I had the invitation, I looked at the invitation card, and there was something which we called a dress code. Because this was an important function with, you know, Queen Elizabeth. And the dress code started off with, like, tuxedo. And I haven't got one of those. The alternative was military uniform. And I hadn't got one of those either. But the third choice was long dress. And I looked at my robe and said, that's long dress. So I turned out at Parliament House in Canberra with very heavy security. Obviously, because they had, you know, not just the politicians, had many ambassadors, and also the Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip. Actually, interestingly, that as a monk, I'm quite cheeky sometimes. And, actually, when I did see Prince Andrew, that's right, he's one of the king's, one of Queen Elizabeth's sons. I think he must be, was it third in line to the throne or something? But anyway, when I saw him at a reception, I went up to him and I took notice that if you ever see pictures of him, he's actually getting quite bald. So I said, if you lose any more hair, Prince, you can become a monk like me. And of course, that being a prince, he laughed because even no matter with your royalty or princes, everybody enjoys a good sense of humor. But anyway, with the visit to Her Majesty the Queen Elizabeth II, as soon as I walked in, of course, security stopped me. Are you allowed in here? And I showed my pass. I'm a Buddhist monk. I'm representing the Buddhist community, so let me in. But the next problem was dinner. And you all know that a monk, Buddhist monk of our tradition, is not allowed to eat any solid food in the afternoon. We can't have rice or curry or any other thing solid. So I was wondering what I was going to do sitting on a table with all these other people. Know, with an important function, I was encouraged to go because this was an honor to the Buddhists in Australia. But you know what happens when a Buddhist monk has dinner with the Queen? It was a three-course meal. And the first course, the first course was fish. But I never got fish. In our traditions, one of the things which monks are allowed to eat in the afternoon, in special situations, is cheese. So my first course was camembert. It was very delicious. And I found out that when they took the plate away, the second course was like a roast lamb. But my second course, my first course was camembert, my second course was cheddar. And when it came to the sweet course, there was a pie with many nuts and fruits made in Australia. But for me, especially, it was dark chocolate, which was another thing which was allowed for a monk. And so it was wonderful that you can adapt at all situations, which is how you deal with the ups and downs of life. If you're having dinner with the Queen of England, or if you're in a trench mixing concrete, as a monk you have all different experiences. And you learn to deal with these in such a way that you can make use of whatever happens in your life. The story which I've been teaching the last year throughout the world where I travel is a story that sometimes when you're walking home from the office, sometimes even in the streets of Bangkok, certainly I remember this in London and it happens in Australia, sometimes that unfortunately you tread in dog poo. Because sometimes the dogs have to do something somewhere, and sometimes that, you know, you step in their the excrement. But I tell the people these days, if ever you tread in dog excrement, never, never scrape it off your shoes. Always take it home with you. Because once you get home, if you have a little garden, you may have a mango tree there, or a papaya tree, in Australia maybe an apple tree. And you can dig that dog excrement under the apple tree, because you know 1 year later your apples will be sweeter than they were the year before. And the reason they're sweet is because of the dog excrement you've dug underneath. But the point is that whenever you taste that sweet apple, you must always remember what you're tasting. Dog poo transformed. And the simile of that story is that whatever happens to you in your life, even some of the difficult experiences which each one of us must face from time to time, if it's a difficult experience, it is like treading in dog excrement. It stinks, it's smelly, it's dirty. But you can always dig it in. And if you know how to use the dog poo of life, how to use it, you can always grow sweeter apples of your life. Now that's the important teaching which we have this evening. If you have a down in life, a difficult period, never think that it's something which you just have to get rid of straight away. Never allow the mind to get into depression. Surely you cannot change the situation you're in, but you can certainly change your attitude towards it. You can't control the world, but you can control your attitude towards it, how you regard it, and what you do with the dog poo of life. But sometimes it's not just the bad times of life, we have the good times of life as well, the ups. And one of the biggest problems I find in human beings today is they are very concerned with the downs, the difficulties. But we neglect paying attention to the upside of life. What I mean by this can be well illustrated by an old story from my teacher Ajahn Chah in the northeast of Thailand. I was very privileged to spend 9 years with Ajahn Chah, my first years here in Thailand. And this was a monk who became very famous because his teachings were down to earth. You could understand them if you were a Westerner, you could understand them if you were a villager in the northeast of Thailand, and certainly the elite generals and politicians from Bangkok could also understand his teachings. But more importantly, there was something you could understand, laugh at, remember, and take home with you. Because what's the point of coming to a talk if it doesn't change your life? You can have more entertainment back home watching the TV than coming here. So it has to be something which is useful. And this was one of Ajahn Chah's greatest skills, that whatever he taught, you could remember, it was useful, and it would change your life. This particular teaching which he gave was a simile of the two chicken farmers, using a metaphor from the area in which he lived, in the villages around Ubon. There were two chicken farmers. The first chicken farmer went to their shed early in the morning to collect the produce from the day before. But that chicken farmer only collected the chicken excrement, the chicken dung, and he left the eggs in the shed to rot. that was a very dumb chicken farmer. Chicken farmer number two would go to the shed every morning. He would leave the chicken poo, the chicken dung, to rot, and he would collect the eggs. Thereby, he could make an omelette for his family and sell the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. That was a very smart chicken farmer. And the meaning of that simile is, when you look into your past, say what happened today, or what happened in the last week, or what's happened so far in your life, what do you collect? Do you collect all the negative experiences of your life? Remember those and worry about those? Are you a chicken farmer who only collects the chicken dung of your life? Or when you look at your past, what's happened today or the days before, do you collect the eggs? Do you look back and remember the beautiful parts, the successful parts, the happy times? Now, unfortunately, most of us are the first type of chicken farmer. When we look back on what's happened today, we look about what went wrong. We look upon the downs of our day. When we look at our life, we remember what went wrong. And when I just came in here, and you were listening to a tape of an earlier talk which I gave, I noticed the same simile. Very often, the reason why we just collect the chicken dung from the past, the bad experiences of the past, because we think that we can learn from the mistakes of the past. And that's what maybe you are taught. Certainly what I was taught. What happens when people focus on the mistakes of the past? Very often they get depressed, dispirited, and they just give up. Because you're focusing on negativity, on mistakes, on the dung of life, and it's not inspiring. It doesn't give you energy. It doesn't help you go forward in your life with zest, with vigor. However, if you're the second type of chicken farmer, instead of understanding you can grow by learning from mistakes, the other way is understanding that you can learn much more from your successes than you can ever learn from your mistakes. So why is it that when we look upon our day, our week, our life, when we look upon how our business, how our company has been faring, why don't, instead of looking at the mistakes, look at what's worked? What created success, prosperity, and happiness? And too often in our lives, we forget that, we take it for granted, and all we do is look at mistakes and try and fix them up. Which means we have an epidemic in our Western world, and I imagine in Bangkok too, of people getting depressed. So much so as an industry now, with medical companies having medicines, chemicals, to cure depression. And those of you old enough to have lived many years on this planet know this is a modern epidemic. Sure that before some people got depressed, but not to the same scale as we have in our modern life. Why do you think that is? It's not so much the stress of life, but how much you have to work. It's the negativity which we've developed in our modern world. Always looking for the faults. We are grown up, or we are taught to be managers. Managers of our life, managers of our education, managers even of our relationship. What a manager does, he looks for the mistakes and fixes them. But there's another way of living our life. Maybe older people might remember this. It is the way that we forgive the mistakes. We put them aside, we fix them sometimes, but we also have an appreciation, a gratitude, a way of looking not just at what went wrong, but looking at what went right. Looking at the successes, looking at the happiness, looking at the beauty of life. It's a strange thing when you change your mind, you know, from an attitude of always focusing on the faults to focusing on the beauty. Sometimes you focus on the faults, you look at the newspapers, you look about global warming, terrorism, whatever, and people get into a terrible negative state. The downs become a slide into depression, a spiral which gets ever deeper, a hole which gets sometimes so deep you can't get out of it. This is our modern negativity, depression, even suicide. But even when you fall into a hole, there's always other ways of looking at it. And it's these attitude changes which are the essence of what I understand as Buddhism. Changing your attitude through meditation, through insight, through listening to good teachings. So it does actually change your life. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but as a monk, as a man, woman in the office, as a business person, or just as a taxi driver, sometimes you'll always get people criticizing you and telling you off, and sometimes scolding you. And very often when you're being scolded, it's very unfair. It's unjustified. You don't deserve that, but here it comes. What should you do when life pours a whole lot of dirt on top of you? To understand, there's a lovely story called the Donkey in the Well story. And I'd like to introduce this because the Donkey in the Well story allows me to actually, instead of just sitting here still, to do a few little movements of my body to enhance the talk with some visual props to get it more interesting. Once upon a time, a donkey was wandering in the forest, just minding his own business and having a peaceful time, chewing a bit of grass here, chewing a leaf on the bush there, not bothering anybody. But he wasn't very careful, he wasn't watching where he was going, and he fell down a well. He never broke his legs or injured himself, but by the time he stood up, he realized he was at the bottom of a disused well. There was no water there. And of course, donkeys can't climb. So he was in a bit of a problem. How could he get out of this hole in the ground into which he'd fallen? So he decided to go and cry for help. Now, I'm not very good at doing donkey sounds, but I'll have a go anyway. He tried to make this sound to get someone's attention. But there was no one there because it was in the forest. He'd been shouting for about an hour or two when someone finally heard him. It was an old farmer who was going into the forest to gather some twigs and some wood. And when he searched the source of that sound, he saw this old donkey had fallen into the well, this stupid donkey. And the farmer never liked that donkey. He was always chewing at his vegetables and giving him a difficult time, because donkeys are always very stubborn. So he looked at the donkey in the well and said, well, I'm probably going to leave it. No, I've got a better idea than leave it down there. Because that's a dangerous well, and I've always been thinking of filling it in. Now I can fill it in and get rid of the donkey at the same time. Ha, ha, ha. He was a very mean and cruel farmer. So he got out a spade and started digging earth and shoveling the earth into the well. And of course, all that earth fell on the donkey. And the donkey didn't know why this farmer was shoveling earth into the well until the donkey realized what the farmer was up to. The farmer was trying to bury the donkey alive. So the donkey, once he realized that, went, even louder. He was screaming for his life. And he screamed and screamed until suddenly he went quiet. He fell silent. Farmer thought, I must have buried that donkey now. Ah, this is great. I don't need to shovel so hard anymore. I can take my time. And moreover, I won't need to be worried about that terrible sound from that silly beast. So he started to shovel at his leisure. But what he didn't know was what was going on at the bottom of the well. Because that donkey, he must have read my book or something, because he got an insight, he got an understanding of what to do when somebody shovels dirt on top of you. All the donkey did, instead of complaining, he simply shrugged it off his shoulders, stamped it in the ground, and he noticed that after every shovel, he was a couple of millimeters higher. Another shovel full of earth, shrugged it off, stamped it into the ground, and he was another couple of millimeters higher. Shovel full after shovel full, he was getting higher and higher. And the farmer, being too busy shoveling, never noticed a pair of donkey ears appear above the rim of the well. Nor did he notice the whole head appeared about 10 minutes later. And when the donkey was high enough, the donkey simply jumped out of the well. According to the story, he bit the farmer on the backside. And the moral of that is, you should always watch your ass. And run away. And of course, I think you should all understand the meaning of that story. When other people, if it's in the office or in your life, shovel dirt all over you, when they give you scorn or abuse or criticism, which is undeserved, you don't need to go, and try and scold people back. You don't need to get upset and angry. All you need to do is, when somebody shovels dirt all over you, simply shrug it off, stamp it in, and you'll find you're a little bit higher than you were before. Thank you so much for criticizing me. Shrug it off, stamp it in, and you're like the donkey, getting higher and higher and higher. And who knows, maybe you can go high enough to bit that person in the backside, which is the law of karma, of course. Now that's how to deal with abuse which we get sometimes. You don't need to get so upset. For those of you who haven't read my book, there's an old story from the time when I first went to Ubon, which was over 32 years ago, just towards the end of the Vietnam War. At that time, there was still a U.S. Army base up in Ubon. Not Army base, sorry, Air Force base. On this occasion, this was a story which went all around Ubon. I remember Ajahn Chah telling me it. There was a soldier, an African-American soldier, working in the base, in the Air Force. He was going in from the base into the center of Ubon. And of course, in those days, we had not the tuk-tuks, the cycle rickshaws. So this poor man was pedaling on the cycles, taking this American soldier, quite a big fellow, from the base into the town. I'm not quite sure, for an afternoon of shopping or evening out or whatever, I'm not sure. But on the way, halfway between the base and the center of town, they passed a shop selling liquor. And many of the driver's friends were outside drinking Mekong and getting drunk. Because they were getting drunk, they had a bit of the bravado of a drunken person. They pointed to that African-American soldier and said, in Lao, where are you taking that filthy dog to? And you all know that if a person understood what was being said, it would be a fight. And that was a big American saying this, being abused. So the driver of the cycle rickshaw turned around and saw the Afro-American GI just smiling, looking at the countryside. Obviously, the soldier did not understand the Isan language. So the driver, the peddler, decided to have some fun. He said, I'm taking this dirty, filthy mongrel from America, throwing him in the Moon River for a wash. The Moon River goes through Ubon. And they all laughed. And the soldier just looked around and smiled. They all had a good joke at the soldier's expense because the soldier didn't understand Lao. But when they got to the center of town, the soldier got down from the rickshaw and started to walk away without paying. And so the driver of the rickshaw said, Sir, you pay me dollars, my fare, in English. However, the soldier just turned around and said in fluent Lao, dogs don't have money. And left. Now what a wonderful way to deal with abuse. If someone calls you a pig, just go oink oink. And that way it doesn't matter what people say to you or do to you. Why do people throw scorn on you anyway? They only do that to try and make you upset. They are trying to control your emotions. Why do you allow people to control you so much? If people call you a dog, it's in the book, Ajahn Chah's tale. If people call you a dog, what should you do? He said, you should look on your bottom to see if you have a tail. If you don't find a tail there, you can't be a dog. End of problem. So why is it that when people get scorned, they get criticized, why is it they allow their happiness to be destroyed? If you're a wise person, you say that your happiness, your peace, your ease is under your power. You don't have to let people control you. You don't have to let people control your happiness. They can say what they like, do what they like. If I can change it, fine. If not, I just make peace with it. I let it go. Good example of that. I'm not quite sure if I told this story last year when I was here. Sometimes there is some problems, especially with the relationship with the Muslim world at the moment, because of the problems with both terrorism and many other issues, especially in Western countries. And we try very best to create harmony between the different religions in the West. We're doing pretty well in Australia, but there's always problems. But someone put me on the spot about a year ago, because there was a lot of articles in a newspaper, because I think an American Marine or some Marines in Guantanamo Bay had been accused of flushing a copy of the Holy Quran down the toilet, which was an abuse of the Muslim scriptures. And much of the Islamic world was upset by those provocative actions, so-called, I'm not quite sure whether it happened or not, but it was alleged. And so I was giving a talk in Australia two nights later, in Perth, where I live. And at question time, someone asked me, if, suppose somebody put a Buddhist holy book, part of the Tripitaka, maybe the Dhammapada, if somebody took a Buddhist holy book and put it down the toilet and flushed it down, as a Buddhist monk, what would you do? You know what my answer was? If somebody flushed a copy of a Buddhist holy book down the toilet, what I would do is call the plumber. That was my response. I'm very practical. But certainly, I would not go and try to take revenge on the perpetrators. Because I made a distinction between what we call the container and the contents. You can destroy the container, but you don't need, please maintain the contents. By which I mean, the books are containers. It's what the book says. The peace, the harmony, the forgiveness, the moving forward rather than always remembering the bad of the past. It's the Dhamma, truth teachings which make people peaceful, be able to live together in harmony. That's what's important. That's the contents of those books. In the same way, when the Taliban in Afghanistan destroyed the Bamiyan Buddha statues, they never destroyed Buddhism. They destroyed a container, which is the Buddha statue. And I was very proud that the Buddhists at the time would not allow themselves to get provoked, to get angry, to actually to seek revenge. Because if the Buddhists had sought revenge on the people who provocatively destroyed their statues, then the Taliban would have not only destroyed the Buddha statues, they would also destroyed Buddhism, the contents. And it's the contents are more important than any container. So you can destroy the books, you can burn them, you can blow up the Buddha statues, you can even kill monks and burn down their monasteries. But please never allow anybody to destroy what those Buddha statues, what those books, what those monks are all about. Teaching peace, forgiveness, harmony and freedom. We have to distinguish between the contents and the container. And if we can do that, not just in our religion and other religions, then we don't mind when people try to upset us by destroying our symbols. Because the symbols aren't primary, they're secondary. It's what they represent is important. And what they should really represent is the peace and harmony, the love between peoples, the freedom of the heart. So we have the opportunity to make a different response to the ups and downs of difficulties in life. It really is up to us. And we can make that difference. And it's very powerful in my life as a teacher to see just how those differences to people's lives are made. An example of an extreme case was when I was teaching in Malaysia recently. After the talk, my organizer said there was a girl who's had a big trauma in her life. Can I give her some quick counseling? Buddhist monks of my tradition are often sought after for counseling. One of the reasons is because we're free. We don't judge. But not only that, we give good advice. And this particular woman had a big problem in her life. I didn't know what it was at first. But she'd been to many other counselors and nothing had worked. So I sat opposite her and asked her what the problem was. She'd been raped violently. Don't know if any of you have had that gross misfortune. Many women have, but they hide it. For her, it was so bad, it was affecting her whole life. She was in a mess. So I had to, in front of her, find a solution. As a monk, what I do is not using psychic powers or anything like that. Just make my mind very peaceful very quickly. And just feel the person in front of you. Get a sensitivity to who they are, what's happened, and how they feel. You don't have to practice too long to get that ability, just to understand a person through silence. And what I did then was find out that that woman was actually quite an amazing lady. She had an inner strength. And I wouldn't say this to anybody. It's actually the only woman I've said this to who's been raped. I said, what's happened to you is wonderful. You are very fortunate. It shocked her. I took a great risk to say that. As a monk, as a man, who's never been in that situation at all. What I was risking is trivializing misunderstanding what she was going through. But I needed to say something out of the ordinary to shock her, to be a circuit breaker, to open her mind to some different way out. And when she was silent, I could really talk to her. And I said, what I mean is this. I think you have it in you that you have some inner strengths and spiritual qualities to find a way out of this, out of the pain, the humiliation, the guilt which you fear. I know that people who have been raped, even though they're not at all culpable, they didn't do anything, people feel that they somehow or other contributed to that situation. Women who have been violated do feel guilty. They shouldn't, obviously, it seems irrational, but they do. So I said, I think that you have the strength to do something. And the reason I said you are fortunate, because I think that this is your journey to learn how to move away from this huge hole, how to climb out. I can't really help you because I've never experienced that. I just do not know what it's like. But I think that when you're through this, your great gift will be able to hold the hand of another woman in a way which I can never do. To hold her hand and say, I know how you feel. Because I've been there too. But more than that, not only can you empathize, having held that person's hand, you know the path out. From your own experience, you can lead her step by step out of the despair, out of the pain, out of the fear, into life beyond that experience. You can give her life back. Show her her freedom. That is why I told her, it's very fortunate for you. Not now, but when you're through this, you'll be an amazing woman who can really help others in a way which few people are privileged to do. So what I gave her there was hope. What I gave her there was a vision of life after the pain. What I gave her there was encouragement. And it worked. This is actually an extreme case. But when you're through this, you'll be an amazing woman who can really help others in a way which few people are privileged to do. So what I gave her there, but I said, there's another way. And this is your way. Once you've found it, share it with others. That's your path. Now it's an understanding of how in the downs of life, while it does not need to allow the pain, the difficulty, the frustration, the despair to overwhelm you, there is something useful to be gained, no matter what has ever happened to you. The downs in life are the dog poo of your life. That's where you learn. That's the fertilizer. That's the stuff of growth. What I call growing pain. The beautiful stuff of life, that's your reward. But that's also growing happiness. Because it's the ups of life as well, which we should always remember too. Very often, as a monk, one of the biggest problems with your disciples in places like Australia is how men and women can live together. How you can have a relationship with somebody which doesn't descend into argument, bitterness, and eventually divorce. Here in Thailand that happens. If it doesn't happen that sometimes that people's marriages are very dysfunctional. Sure, they live together, but they're not happy together. What a strange thing that is. Have you ever noticed in your life, if you have children, no matter who your children are, you'll love them forever? It doesn't matter what character they are. But when you choose a husband, when you choose a wife, you spend more time choosing your partner than you do even selecting your car. You take them out many times. You check them out, you know, with your friends, with their parents. Sometimes these days you even test drive before you commit. But why is it when you go through all of those tests, you can't love your partner the same way you love your child? You can't love them unconditionally. What a great shame that is with the relationship we have. And I mention this because this is one of the great downs of life. Your relationships, your marriage, your partnership. And if we have a good attitude, it's amazing what we can do and how we can, man and woman, can learn how to live together in reasonable peace and harmony. And then perhaps, if men and women can live in peace and harmony, then maybe people in a country can live in peace and harmony. Maybe in a region we can learn how to give and take and live in harmony. Maybe our world can stop conflict if we learn how to stop conflict in our own house. So how on earth can we learn to do that? So much of conflict starts with the fault-finding mind. Look at your partner. When you first fall in love, they're the most wonderful person in the world. When you see the divorce lawyer, you wonder why I ever even went out with such a person. What's gone wrong? What's changed? Actually, they're pretty much the same person. What's changed is your attitude, the way you're looking. When you first meet someone, you fall in love, you know, you've just got this positive attitude. They say love is blind. You heard that expression, love is blind? Well, if love is blind, then marriage is an institution for the blind. But actually, if it's an institution for a blind, it just ends in divorce. But there's another way, to open your eyes and to see that person in front of you, the one you've committed to. To understand that don't just look at their faults. Of course they've got them. They had them from the very beginning. But look at them for who they are. And don't just look at their faults. Look at their beauty as well. Too often in life, when we don't look at another person's beauty, we can get angry. If you have an enemy, a person in the office who gives you a hard time, a person who lives next door who's always abusing you, or someone in your family who doesn't like you, a great way of overcoming that problem and having a bit of harmony in your family is looking for some beauty in your enemy. Something you can respect, something which you can find endearing. There was a funeral ceremony some years ago. An old man had died. And in Australia, I'm not sure if you do this in funeral ceremonies in Thailand, it's been a while since I stayed here, we have very commonly what's called eulogies, where close relations stand up and read something about the person's life. To try and encapsulate who they were at their funeral ceremony, to let the people know what a type of person they were. Usually just recording all the beautiful good things which a person did in their life. It's called the eulogy. Literally means like good words. And this particular time, the deceased's wife came up to say something about her husband's life. And she told a story from which her husband had told her from the time he was at school, in grade school. She said this experience affected his whole life. She said, what had happened in the school, the class were having an argument. There's about to be a fight. And the school teacher told everybody to sit down, ordered them immediately, and told them to get out a plain piece of paper and to draw a vertical line down the middle of that piece of paper. And on the top of the piece of paper, write down the name of the other boy in the class who you hate the most. Write his name down. And on the left-hand side of that line, write why you hate him. All the rotten things which he does. All the unkind words which he says to you. Write it all down. All the kids in the class were busily scribbling all about their enemy, the one they hated the most. It took them only a few minutes to fill the whole of the left side. The teacher said, right, finished. Now, on the other side of the line, on the right-hand side, write down something you respect about that person. Some kindness you've seen them do. Go on, write it. It took them a while to get the first thing down. But the teacher forced them, write down what you like about that person. And soon they filled up most of the right-hand side. Now, said the teacher, carefully fold that piece of paper down the line. Tear it in half. Now put the left-hand side with all the stuff you hate about that person. Throw it in the waste bin. The right-hand side, what you respect and like about that person, get up and go and give it to them. So every child in the room received a list of what their enemy liked about them. That changed the whole dynamic of that class. It changed the life of her husband. Because for his whole life, he kept that piece of paper in his wallet. His wife took out that piece of paper and showed it to the people who were attending the service for the funeral. He said whenever he was upset, whenever he was depressed, he'd look at this piece of paper. This is what his enemy thought about him. Imagine what his friends might think. He wasn't such a bad person after all. That took him through some of the worst disappointments and downs of his life. This little piece of paper. If his enemy could see this beauty in him, he could see it in himself. He learned how to see the beauty in his enemies. When she finished saying that with tears, three or four people stood up. Old classmates. They too took out the same piece of paper. They'd also kept them. It meant so much to know that your enemy can look at you and see something beautiful. It means so much for you to see beauty in the people you would otherwise hate. So, the next time you have an argument with your partner, get out a piece of paper, put a line down the middle, put your partner's name, husband, wife, put their name on the top, and on the left-hand side, write all the mean, terrible, spiteful, lazy, selfish things which they do. On the other side, write all the beautiful, wonderful things which they've done, why you loved them in the first place. Tear it down the middle. Put the left-hand side in the rubbish bin and go and give the good side to your mate in life, your partner. Understand what we're doing here? We have to force people through this exercise to see something beautiful in their enemy. Now, because I've been a monk, I've been training in this for such a long time. It's incredibly powerful when you meet somebody who is in a bad mood. You look for their beauty. You don't look for their anger or their scolding. If you do that, it's incredibly powerful. They change. I told this story last night in Singapore. one of my disciples in Sydney, Julie. She's quite a successful businesswoman. She imports fashion items from around the world, even here from Bangkok, and sells them in department stores in Sydney. She's got a very good business. But on this occasion, she was doing some business with a big firm in London. It was a very lucrative contract, so she really wanted to get it. So she flew all the way from Sydney to London, which is halfway around the world. If you're doing business, you haven't got time to get over jet lag. She arrived, had a shower, went to the big office block to meet the board and the CEO. Soon as she came in, the directors met her and said, "You've wasted your time." The CEO, who runs this company, he's a very, very hard man at the best of times. Today he's come in a terrible bad mood. He's been shouting at us, "There's no way in the world that he's going to sign your contract. It's the wrong day. Go back to Sydney, come back next month." It's too far. Fortunately, she knew a bit of Buddhism. I think she was born in England, living in Australia for many years now. Because she'd heard talks like this before, she decided to do a little bit of metta meditation. Only 5 minutes, that's all she had in the corner of a room while she was waiting for the CEO to come down. When she heard the CEO was about to come in, she got up, met him as he came in. The CEO was in a foul mood. He was about to kill anybody who just came in his way. He was murderous, psychopathic. But what this dude, I was so proud of her. She said she didn't plan this, she couldn't even think it, it just came out of her mouth. She looked at this CEO, who was fuming, and he said, "You've got such beautiful blue eyes, just like my daughter Holly." And the CEO melted. All his anger drained from his face. He said, "Oh, really?" And the contract was signed within a half an hour. And when the CEO left, she couldn't leave because all the directors were huddling around her. "Teach us. How do you do that? Teach us. We want to find out what your secret is." Because they were just so impressed. And she came and told me the story as soon as she came back to Australia. It's amazing because what she did in this business leader who was in a bad mood, because you're stressed out with all that responsibility, you've got so much to do if you're CEO of a big company. Instead, she saw something beautiful in that guy. Just something simple, just he had beautiful blue eyes which reminded her of her baby daughter on the other side of the world. She wasn't playing. She actually was looking for beauty, she saw it. And when somebody sees beauty in you, you see it in yourself. And that's what you show to others. Whatever you look for, the other person shows you. If you look for the faults in your partner, for what's wrong with them, they will show you them and more faults as well. But if you see their beauty, see their goodness, their kindness, they will show you that back and more. Part of my early life in Australia as a monk, used to go teaching in prisons. It's a great place to teach Dhamma. There's some really violent and evil men in those prisons. And maybe one of the most notorious of criminals was Ronnie Cray. He was a very famous criminal in London, one of the Cray twins. He's such a nice guy. Because I train myself to see something beautiful in him. And sometimes you see these murderers and rapists and very violent people, and you go up to them, and instead of like, "Wow, that's a murderer, he's raped people, maybe he can rape me." I went to this one jail once. They had to install a new security system because many visitors
people like me had been raped. Sometimes prisoners in jail have already got such a long sentence. They're going to die in jail. They know they're going to die in jail. Nothing more can be done to them. They've got no fear of punishment. So this one day when I checked in to visit the jail to teach some meditation, the prison officers gave me what looked like a ballpoint pen. They said, "This is not a pen, this is a security alarm." He said, "You'll notice on the ceilings throughout the prison, you'll see what looks like smoke detectors. They're not smoke detectors, they're alarms. If you get attacked, point the pen straight at one of these detectors, press the top. The alarm will go off in the control room, and also will know exactly where you are. It will come and get you. Because too many people have been raped and beaten up in the past month. It's a very expensive security system which the local government had to install." They said, "Be very careful with this pen. It looks like an ordinary pen. Don't let any of the prisoners know what it is. It's a secret." So I walked into my meditation class. There was quite a few people, 30 or 40 prisoners there. As soon as I walked in, one of the leading prisoners said, "Ah, you've got one of those pens as well. One of those security pens." And straight away he looked at me and he said, "Do you think that you could press that button at the top before I got to you and raped you?" And I looked at him and said, "No." He said, "You're right. Before you even thought of it, I could get you." He said, "Don't need to worry, because we like you. If someone tried to jump you, I'd jump them first." That was my security system. Just because I'd been kind to others and seen the goodness in these prisoners, they responded by being good to me. That's how it works. So, I think the lights have come up a bit, so it's a sign for me to finish off and start opening up for some questions. But that's the ups and downs in life. Some stories about how we can change our attitude to life. We can't change what happens to us, but certainly we can change the way we look at it. And we can change the way we look at ourselves, look at our partner, look about some of the messes we get up into life. If it's any dog poo, remember it's fertilizer. So don't say, "Oh, why'd it happen to me?" You're so lucky. You should dig it in and become a better person. But also remember, you learn much more from your successes in life. What works, repeat it. What worked with your partner, repeat it. What worked with your health, repeat it. Never underestimate learning from your successes. Thank you.